Welcome to 60 Scales and the Truth, a podcast where amazing guitar players reflect on their lives and on how they got where they are today. My name is Niels Guns. I'm a journalist, podcast maker, and a guitar fanatic. Thanks for tuning in. My guest today is a former podcast host. He lives in Bristol, was educated in Bath.
Yeah, it's true.
And he has a mother who destroyed his electric guitar. All for the better, because my guest is now one of the best, or maybe the best, acoustic guitar player in the world.
According to my mom.
According to your mom. Okay, welcome to this show. Guitar, acoustic guitar guy, Mike Dawes. Right. Welcome.
Hey, pleasure, man. That's such a very sweet introduction. Yes, my mom's never, ever going to forget that.
So what happened? Your mom destroyed your guitar.
Yeah, it was. Well, it wasn't her fault. It was
gravity. She wasn't Pete Townsend, right?
Or No, it was gravity's fault. So this was, well, I got into electric guitar before acoustic guitar. And because, you know, I wanted to rock when I was 12 years old. And obviously, when you buy a starter guitar, you buy the starter guitar equipment. So my parents very graciously got me a beautiful Squire Telecaster, but it was a cream color. Excuse me, I'm choking on strip waffle residue. We're in the Netherlands, as I'm sure you know. I was worried that the cream color, this shows how materialistic one is when they're in their early teens, or 12 years old I was. I swapped it for a Tobacco Sunburst Les Paul because I wanted to be Slash. Ah. Now, as we all know, Les Pauls have a very fragile headstock join. And it can be susceptible to the slightest bit of damage can cause it to kind of crack. And that's what happened when my mum unfortunately placed it on the guitar stand for me, you know, picking up after her son like many good mothers do. The hook on the guitar stand at the bottom had rotated the other way. So it was kind of angled down instead of kind of angled up. So when she placed it on, she walked away and it kind of fell off flat on its head and broke. The headstock broke. But the saving grace of that story is that whilst it was being repaired, it was laying flat. It was being glued. We glued the headstock back on, and it was laid flat on the dining room table, kind of like this table here. And obviously, you're not supposed to play the guitar whilst it's being glued when you're 12, 13, or whatever. Actually, I believe this happened a little later on when I was in my mid-teens. Excuse me again, strip waffle and coffee burp. I then kind of decided to play the guitar like a piano. I was experimenting with tunings, and that's where I kind of ended up with dadgad tuning, D-A-D-G-A-D, kind of like that.
When you were 12 already?
No, my timeline's a bit wonky. I got my guitar when I was 12, but this happened in my kind of late teens. Hmm. And that kind of migrated me onto the acoustic guitar through solo performance. You know, my friends would come around and I'd say, hey, check out this weird piano guitar thing that I've figured out. And they said, oh, you should come and play it at the local open mic nights, the local bars, things like that. And obviously that, you get surrounded by these wonderful acoustic musicians, these singer-songwriters, poets, all kinds of artists. And from that point, I was selling little homemade £1 demo CDs that I made on my parents' Windows 98 computer CD-ROM drive. And that funded the purchase of my first acoustic guitar, which was a Taylor. And the rest kind of, you know, I picked up the guitar again in the proper way and play it in some kind of slightly bastardized version of the proper way ever since.
Hey, but you as a teenager... in what way did you play guitar? Like, was it instantly, you were instantly caught by the instrument?
Yeah. The only reason I got a guitar, so I was always interested in music. Excuse me, I'm going to have a sip of water because this.
Yeah, I fed you too many Stoba.
Yeah. No regrets. It's beautiful stuff. Recommended. I was always into music because my dad is a trumpet player and a percussionist. And my mum had an old synthesizer. And I was always bashing around on it, working out Phil Collins melodies and things like this, you know. This was my discovery through the 90s, and it's everything that was on the airwaves in the 90s. But ultimately what happened is we moved around a lot when I was a kid, settled into different towns and cities around the country as my dad changed jobs a few times. And when I was 12, it was, you know, look, I've got to fit in at this new school. What do the cool kids do? Well, the cool kid has a guitar. I guess I want to play a guitar now, you know, just basic kind of wanting to fit in kid stuff. But of course, when I first got the guitar, very, very blessed to convince my parents that it wasn't just a fad and it was something I was interested in, when realistically, it could have been a fad.
Yeah.
But as soon as I could play the first notes, I was hooked, and that was it. And it was rock bands, metal bands, all through my teenage years. I was in a metal band called Shrapnel, and we played kind of mid-2000s Boston metalcore music in camo pants, you know, grew the hair out, all that kind of stuff. But really, it was this hybrid influence of acoustic music in my home life that kind of brought me into the world of acoustic guitar.
And, but you moving around that many times, was your instrument then also something to hang on to, so to say, right? Like, this is my bass.
Yeah, I think once I got into guitar, we didn't move around that much more. Okay. It was pretty stationary. But it definitely became part of my identity, like it does for a lot of musicians, especially, you know, this is pre-social media. I'm so sorry.
I hear the strobe baffle there.
It's really lodged in there, but
I'll make a nice clip out of this.
Yeah, I think, Mike Dawes coughing whilst eating Dutch snacks compilation. I think that pre-social media, we tie a lot of our identities into our hobbies. I mean, post-social media as well. But, you know, when you meet people, it's pretty fun to have a thing that you do or that you're known for. And in school, it's like, oh, Mike, he plays guitar. He's the guitar guy, or he's one of the guitar guys or something. And socially, that enabled you to kind of get into friendship groups and things like that when you're still socially developing. You know, you move to a new college. Oh, where are the other guitar guys? Cool. I guess we're friends now, you know? Mm-hmm. So that in that respect, it was part of my identity in a big way. But I don't know, it was a different time back then. It's interesting. We were talking earlier about your Gen X and I'm a millennial, mm-hmm. and how different things were, yeah. Just socially and getting into technology and things like that.
My first lesson in college was, what is an internet browser?
Yeah. Can you imagine? Exactly. Well, funnily enough, my family was the last family in my school year to get a computer at home. So I consider myself pretty technologically illiterate, because, you know, when you're that age and your brain is becoming slightly less malleable as you grow up, I feel like every month counts more. I felt like I was losing the ability to retain new information, you know? Mm-hmm. And around that time, another reason why I really gelled with the acoustic guitar later on is because all my friends were getting into, you know, Cubase, Logic, Pro Tools, things like that. And I really struggled with that. I actually, to this day, I struggle with the technological stuff. It's very basic to almost all my peers. Mm-hmm. But I think when I found acoustic guitar, it was almost like, aha, I can just play gigs and not worry about all that stuff, you know. So that's a part of the appeal for me, for sure, is I just do not feel confident with technology.
Okay, so yeah, because I'm trying to imagine, because it's also from a musical point of view, super interesting, the things that you're doing, but I can imagine that it appeals, like, because acoustic guitar you can pick up wherever, whenever, and just play, right?
Exactly. That's always been an appeal. I think a lot of musicians are control freaks by nature and perfectionists, and, you know, we all want to practice and practice and practice and get the songs perfect and get the licks perfect and everything. But for non-acoustic players, there's a whole extra step, which is, okay, well, now we have to fill in the other side of the semicircle, which is, how do we produce this track that they have in their head? What do the drums do? What do the bass do? What do the synths do? How do we compress it? How do we EQ it? All of this stuff. And of course, I do that as well. And I have a great engineering partner, Josh Clark, based out of the UK. He's a wonderful bluegrass producer, and we've had a good relationship since the very beginning, for all of my kind of professional output. But it's a lot less considered when, you know, I'm not worrying about what the bassist is going to play. I'm worrying about what my thumb's going to play. Mm. And that's in the arrangement process, which is more fun for me. I like to be able to say, oh, if I hit this on this area of the string, it sounds like this. If I hit it this hard, it sounds like this. I don't need to worry about any other people messing it up. I don't need to worry about the social ramifications.
Pause there. Yeah. Because that I find interesting. I talked with you once before, and I asked you why. I actually showed a video of you to my 3-year-old son, and afterwards, the first thing he asked is, why is he alone?
Wow.
Which I find a very good question, actually.
Profound.
And so you being a perfectionist, that also...
I'm not easy to work with. In fact, I'm going to be very honest and, like, share that, you know, my girlfriend and I have had some problems with my inability to work, in her words, with other people. So like I can take orders in mm-hmm. the sense that, you know, I have a session gig with Justin Hayward from the Moody Blues that I've had for 10 years. And if he tells me to play something, I'll do it. Of course, that's easy. But when I'm on this kind of adjacent wavelength where I'm working with someone who's, you know, has a mutual interest in my success in the sense of, say, I don't know, a manager or a agent or something like that, I find it very hard to take, I'm admitting this, I find it very, very hard to accept the opinions of other people's about what I'm doing. It's very, very hard. Because
well, what happens if you're in a situation like that?
I just think every other human's incompetent. And I know they're not. Like, logically, that's a ridiculous thing to think.
Yeah,
and
but it's something difficult to, you know it, but you feel something different.
Yeah,
right?
The emotional response is no. You know, and I brick wall people a lot. It makes it very hard for other people to work with me. I'll admit that. And it's something that I'm trying to work on, obviously, because you can't, I mean, for selfish reasons, you've got to work on it because you can't get to that next stage in your career without making other people money. That's just like a fact. You, if you want to have a long career, you have to learn to make other people money, right? That requires working with other people. So I have a manager now. We have a relationship, which is had its ups and downs, but he's awesome. Mm-hmm. He's awesome. He's like the guy, you know? I still have the reflexes from time to time of like, I think your opinion's wrong, but then I have to kind of take a deep breath and say, this guy's a professional. I need to start delegating things to other people in order to grow. But growing up, leaving the band and taking it back to the guitar, that is, you know, the way I play guitar and the way I tour is 100% a symptom of that. You know, I was talking to, I'm wearing a underneath this Pliny hoodie, plus for my
really
second,
nice one,
yeah,
I have to say.
Yeah, it was my second favorite Australian.
Tommy Manor will be
there
in the first.
There you go, we got there in the end. Underneath here, I've got a Cardinal Black shirt on. I live in, another guy who lives in Bristol is Chris Buck.
Yeah, so he
lives a few blocks away from me in Bristol. I went to see his show in Bristol and he kind of said, man, like, even if I could do what you do, I would never want to do that. You know, and I get that from a lot of band guys. It's like they remind me about how ridiculous and stressful it is to do a solo show without a band and without anyone to hide behind, you know. And when COVID happened and I came back to that first gig in like 2021, that's when I felt that. I was like, what am I doing? This is insane. Like, I wish I had a band here so I could actually enjoy myself more and not stress about every little mistake and all of this. But then you sacrifice the control. And it's six of one, half dozen the other. What's it going to be? You're going to sacrifice some control in order to have an easier gig? Or are you going to just live on the edge and, you know, give the people the show of watching someone on a tightrope and keep the control? And
Or can it both be there, Mike? I mean,
yeah. In an ideal world, so in the future, what I want to do is do a tour which is exactly like that, where, say, the first half is me solo and the second half is me with a band. That would be a really cool show, I think. And I still need to build the repertoire to get there, a few more albums, I think. But that would be a solution, yes. It is. I think if you ask any solo guitar player, it's part of the reason they do what they do is that it's hard to let go of that control element. I'm talking about psychological stuff, but if we wind it right back, what it really comes down to is I bloody love playing acoustic guitar solo. I love the idea of creating a full emotional spectrum, harmony and rhythm and all those emotional responses we get from those things. I love creating that with my hands. That's the coolest thing ever. I don't need to search on Google E minor backing track blues, click it, and then play to get those emotions. I can just do that, you know, and that's why the composition and arrangement process is so fun. Add to that I do a lot of covers, like in arrangements, then it's like I'm, you know, those dreams you have as a kid where it's like your favorite bands on stage, they're like, oh no, our guitar player has suddenly fallen ill. Does anyone here know the songs? Me. And then you go and then you rock, you know. That's the feeling you get when you one-man band arrange one of your favorite songs.
But isn't that, you're already doing that and you say, in an ideal world, I want to have my own solo thing and also with the band, but it doesn't your heart just say the thing that I'm doing now is just the thing I want to do already?
Or? That's true. But I've also, since working with Tommy Emmanuel, I found such a beauty and joy in collaboration. So Tommy and I released an EP together. Mm-hmm. That was an incredible, incredible opportunity because he's, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the greatest of all time. I don't think I've ever met a serious guitar player who doesn't think that Tommy is like the greatest.
He's the greatest.
He's the greatest human. He's just the greatest human. He's my favorite Australian. Sorry, Plenty. Since then, I've done more collaborations. I've invited other guitar player friends, Jack Gardner, Plenty. I've collaborated with Periphery, the metal band.
Nick Johnston.
Yeah, I all these people. I recently just did a country session. I just did, I've done stuff on the late Dr. John's record, Ailstorm, a pirate metal band, a variety of things. I just did a video game. I did some guitars for the new Prince of Persia game, which is out now. Mm. These kind of things I wouldn't have done prior to working with Tommy, or at least I would have felt less confident doing it.
What did he tell you then? What was his advice?
It's nothing that he told me. It was just what I felt playing with him. Mm. You know, it's like the stress of doing everything yourself comes down, but the joy of the emotional response of connecting with melody and harmony and rhythm and all of that is still there. Mm. And then there's something extra which you get from sharing that with another human being, mm-hmm. As a creative. So another thing is I'm terrible at improvising. Like really bad. Like it's one of the things that has held me back from just jumping up with, anyone and jamming. The lazy brain will attribute that to the fact that every song I do is more or less in a different guitar tuning. My roadmap is kind of there for composition and arrangement and doesn't lend itself fantastically to improvisation in an experience sense. But the realist brain is that I just didn't put my hours into mm-hmm. that craft. Mm-hmm. I've got better since working with Tommy just because I have been put on the spot and that's what needs to happen. And I definitely advise younger people to throw themselves out there with other musicians. But all the years I spent of just closing myself off from others and just doing it all myself, I didn't have that opportunity. Mm. I didn't grow up in Nashville or Georgia. I grew up in like the southwest of England in a tiny town. I mean, you mentioned Bath. These are the big cities for university later in life. But my upbringing was in, a small village just like this, mm-hmm. There weren't really many other musicians to play with. That being said, improvisation is a string that I'm working on and I wish I have had it in my bow for longer because that would then enable the confidence to work with others more. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So that's something which is very, very important for people to understand is, working with others will make you grow as a musician, which can only help your craft, even mm-hmm. if you're trying to do the solo thing.
But it seems like, in a way, it's a beautiful thing to be in a quest for that kind of balance, right? Like if I hear you talking, it's Mike Dawes as a musician, as an artist, it's not finished.
No.
You know what I mean? Like you're searching, which I always find a beautiful thing if people are searching, right? I mean,
well, it's a constant journey. Tommy is still, at 4 in the morning, if we have a lobby call at 4:30 in the morning to get two flights to go to Rome or whatever, he's in there playing to the guy doing the night shift at reception. He's always playing. Mm-hmm. Just now I wanted to play, just we got in here. It's a journey and the joy is in the journey. Like if you're getting a good emotional response and you're feeling good about playing and making music, then you should just do that more. And every time you play, you'll get slightly better. There's mm-hmm. no silver bullet, but there might be, to being wherever you want to be, but there might be hundreds of little tiny changes, little tiny, I'm trying to make a bullet analogy now, little tiny shrapnel knives that you can mm-hmm. work on to get up to that silver bullet. And then the happiness comes from that journey in the first place.
So why do you think somebody like Tommy Emmanuel, there you found the door within yourself to open up in that way? Why? Can you explain that? My Dutch, English sometimes a bit messy, but sorry.
Well, anyone who's been around Tommy will just feel like that anyway. I think the guy's just a naturally giving human, he wants to help everyone around him. But I think the recording process of the EP was really interesting for that, because so when I make my records, I go to a castle in a place called Chippenham, in the southwest of England. Mm-hmm. It's a converted castle. It's a recording studio, and we set up all the mics, and we have so many mics. So my new solo album, which is coming out in the summer, best acoustic guitar recording I've ever done. We put so much work into it, and man, I'm just so happy, especially with the percussion and stuff, just taming it and compressing it and all that stuff. It's just, oh, it's chef's kiss, right?
I'm not sure if it catches in video, but your face changes you talk about it.
I'm so excited for the sound of this album and the songs and everything about it. So anyway, that's not supposed to be a plug. There's a point to this. We use 12 channels for just my acoustic guitar. Mm. So there's pickups, there's mics, there's routing into various analog pedals and all this kind of stuff. And I do loads of takes until we get it. When I was with Tommy, we recorded the EP. So bear in mind, I usually record maybe one song in a day, because I'll take my time and play it over and over and over and over and over and over. And then we have coffee and then I play it over and over. It has to be right. Typically, we just go with the second take. You know, that's usually the best one. Or we take bits from different ones and things like that. Mm-hmm. With Tommy, we did 5 songs in 5 takes. 1 take for each song. Done. Mm-hmm. We played the song. I was like, do you want to do it again? He goes, no, that was great. Let's go listen. And then he's there in the control room dancing and next song. Okay. So we did a whole EP in like an hour and a half, just going in there, listening to it, going in there, listening to it, that kind of thing. And that was my first experience working with people outside of the engineer I'd always worked with, the town I'd always recorded in, all of that in the south of England. This was in LA. It was Studio City. It was next door to Chris Lord Alge's studio. It was with a wonderful engineer called Mark DeSisto. And that felt like making a real record. And it was almost like, oh, this is how you make a record. Mm. You just capture the lightning in a bottle. Remember what I said about inevitably we just use the second take? It's kind of like that. The millennial in me strives for this digital perfection that the Gen Zers are achieving through their proficiency with technology and the time they spend at home. They don't go on tour. They just make the music sound freaking perfect and then on to the next one. The old school way of doing it, Tommy's generation, Mark DeSisto's generation, dare I say our generation to an extent as well, is about capturing lightning in a bottle. And especially with an acoustic recording, that's what you want to get.
But that's so, also about being able to let go.
Well, right? that's what it taught me. Like, I wouldn't have done that out of choice. Mm. Like, if my engineer Josh had said, this is how we're going to do it, I would have just said, no. Mm. But obviously, when I'm with Tommy, I'm just a kid. I'm not going to say no. I'm going to, remember what I said? I always said I'm good at taking orders. Yes, sir. Let's do it. You know what I mean? Yeah. I needed that in order to do that. So if you go on Spotify and you listen to, by the time this comes out, I mean, I've just released Everlong from the new record. And
it's beautiful. It's really beautiful the way you play.
Well, thanks, man. But if you listen to that recording, let's take that as an example. Listen to that recording and then listen to the Accomplice Volume 3 record with Tommy. Say that the Be My Mistake would be a good example, I think. They're both acoustic guitar recordings, but very different vibes. Everlong has had work put into with the production, and it's an engineering feat. And I feel that this might give it away. I had a metal producer and a bluegrass producer work on it, right? That's the sound in my head. That's what I want to sound like. And it's perfect. The Tommy stuff is also perfect, but it's totally different because it sounds loose. It sounds like two guys that just played it once. It sounds like two people having fun. And I think that in the context of two musicians playing on the same track, that's what you want. You don't want it to sound like one guy did his part in his country and then sent it over email and the other guy. You want that connection. There's no click track or anything on any of the Tommy stuff. It's all raw and it flows. So they're two different acoustic recording experiences. I would say mine is more of a millennial Gen Z approach, and Tommy's is more of an old school, like let's put on a record approach. Mm-hmm. And I love it for that reason. And it taught me that I can let go more. And that actually filtered through into the recording of a lot of the other songs on the new record, because there are a lot of songs on there with, you know, no click track. It's very flowy. And it was like, I think I have a Be My Mistake solo version and another song I don't want to name because I don't know when this is coming out. they're the last two tracks on the record. If you listen to those, you'll hear that I'm trying to get that kind of spirit into it, you know. So I'm trying to get the best of both worlds on that record, if that makes sense. Sorry, I ramble. Yeah,
No. But I'm really triggered actually by your bond with Tommy Emmanuel, and because I met him too, and I felt his presence in a room.
We met because we did the interview together, didn't we?
Yeah,
on the big couch.
And also before I talked to him by phone, and already by phone he made a big impression. Just the things he told. But I'm curious. Was that an instant bond with you, or did you need to learn to let go throughout? What actually was the first time you met him?
This is really fun. So the first time was I was just invited to open for Tommy in the States on the East Coast for maybe like five shows, just as a little test. I think what it was his manager wanted to sign me, and he said, okay, let's just get Mike out on a few shows and then let me know how the response is. Did the crowd respond to him? You know, it was kind of like an audition without knowing it was an audition. Mm. And the first show was in Scranton, Pennsylvania, which is where the US Office TV show is based.
Ah.
I remember that because I played the Office theme tune to minimal applause. but I met him. The dressing room was underground, and I went in there and I was like, oh yeah. And I knew that Tommy wanted to, he liked to play songs with his openers. So I like prepared some parts to some of his songs ahead of time, you know, going back to what I was saying about over-preparing, you know. And he was like, oh, it's great to meet you. And yeah, that's great. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Let's not do that tonight. You know, let's just have fun tonight and then we'll see what happens. Yeah. Okay. And I was like, oh God, maybe he doesn't like me. Oh God. You know? And then I go up and I'm about to go on stage, and then he's just standing side stage and he's about to watch me. And I'm nervous, you know. I'm like, I'm about to play. It was a sold out show, you know. But you know, your two balconies, your big theater, and just as I go on stage, he goes, "Now remember, if you want to have a big crowd, you got to have a big sound." Tommy likes these little rhymes. Mm-hmm. He has so many. And I go, okay, so I go out there and I open on this really loud song, and I have the wedges turned up and everything, and I get the crowd all clapping along and just kind of stuff that a typical opener doesn't do at an acoustic guitar show, if you were to read it, you know, mm-hmm. in a biography. And as the crowd, like, they really liked it, you know, and they were going into it and they were clapping along. And as I'm like getting all these beats going on the guitar and the crowd are clapping, I turn and look at Tommy into the mic and go, if you want to have a big crowd, you got to have a big sound. And he's just going, yes, brother, yes. And I think we just clicked. We clicked on that. Another thing Tommy said to me was, we were on a tour bus on another tour. So we've done so many tours now, and I'm absolutely blessed. And we've done the Netherlands, and we're going to be doing a huge tour in Europe in the fall, by the way. We're doing Germany, Austria, Switzerland, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Denmark. It's going to be awesome. He said to me he doesn't want an opener to just go out there and get a lukewarm response. He goes, we're not here for lukewarm responses, are we, Mike? We're here to kill, maim, and destroy. So that's our thing. We always look at each other and say, kill, maim, and destroy. That's it. If we need psyching up before a show, you know, typically on the first show of a tour, I get a little bit antsy, a little bit nervous sometimes. And I just remember, kill, maim, destroy.
But he seems like a person that because you told me I'm a bit neurotic and I'm a bit perfectionist. That's beautiful that you encountered somebody like that who made you also feel like that.
Tommy, you know, I can talk about Tommy for ages and my experiences with him.
We might do, or whatever.
Yeah, he's a unique individual because it doesn't matter what you do, it doesn't matter what he thinks of you professionally. He's just really nice. Mm. And he makes you feel like you can do a good job, you know? So he would have been standing side stage going, yeah, even if I was bombing, you know, he's that kind of guy. So he makes you feel good and he makes you feel confident enough to take your show to that next level and try new things and all that, you know? I feel like he's like an uncle, honestly, you know, at this point, he came around to my house around Christmas, you know, drove up to see me in England, all this kind of stuff, you know, whenever he's home and I'm in Nashville, you know, we hang out. He's just the best.
Another big name.
He lifts people up.
He does. Yeah. He does. And at that show, I saw you with Tommy. You killed it as an opener, man.
Yes, man. Like, kill, maim, and destroy.
Yeah, you maimed it and destroyed it. Everybody was like, whoa, this is an opener? What happened?
Thanks, man.
Another big name I want to talk to you about, because all the guests that I'll be having here, most of them mention Eddie Van Halen.
Mm.
So that's probably a returning topic in this series as well. And I saw a video of you online the day after he died.
Mm.
And it actually made quite an impression on me seeing you talking about him, like, because it really hit you, right? And
yeah,
what did he mean as a musician to you?
I think when Eddie Van Halen died, it was the first time. So prior years to that, we'd had David Bowie, Lemmy, mm-hmm. you know, there was almost this meme of so many of these legends kind of passing away in the music business. But there's something intangible about Eddie's impact on the guitar that made him kind of immortal. And I think he is immortal. I mean, he's certainly got an immortal legacy. It was a shock because of that, because it was like, he can die? Like, what? That doesn't make any sense. That's crazy. Maybe because, you know, I was born when I was born, and a lot of his, you know, pioneering music came before I was born. It almost like cemented it into legacy already. Mm. So it was almost like he's there forever anyway, in my mind. But, you know, when I started playing guitar, obviously I learned a lot of his tunes. I was playing in rock bands, all of that kind of stuff. A lot of the techniques that I use on the acoustic come from Eddie. A lot of the inspirations I have are inspired by Eddie. It was just, it's like Tommy. It's Eddie and Tommy are like my guys, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
But also contextually, it was during COVID lockdowns as well.
That was a rough period.
It was a rough, right? I hadn't played guitar for 8 months. I literally just like, and bear in mind, before then I was on the road for 11 months of a year, like every year. All year, basically.
At home, you didn't play either?
At home, I didn't play. I didn't want to do anything. Lots of life changes. I mentioned to you, I won't go into too much details on here, but, you know, it was a rough time.
Mm-hmm.
It was a rough time for various reasons and timing reasons, relationships ending, nearly lost a house, all that kind of stuff. So all the tours going, which were this source of not just income, but also fun and joy. And
yeah, your life.
And purpose. Without the shows, there wasn't a purpose because there was no one to play for. And I just didn't want to play for myself. So 8 months, and I'm not the only guitar player that just didn't play for it. I know of many others who I won't name, but they just found it very hard. But when Eddie died, the next day, all I did was play guitar.
Oh.
And then I literally ended up playing a Van Halen song. Like, it just, I don't know. It just, I can't really think of any words to describe it. I'm not a particularly spiritual guy, but I felt I felt inspired by reflecting on the legacy of one of the greatest people to ever pick up a guitar.
That gave you some sort of purpose then, so to say, like now I need to connect with my instrument again.
It's more like, how dare I be so arrogant to not play? You know, like, why am I not playing right now?
But it's a very interesting point, that purpose you mentioned, because like, you could say, I play a little bit of guitar, can't have a name, but I play up in the attic, right? And that's a topic for me as well. Where is my purpose to it?
Yeah.
So in some way, the purpose is just sometimes even as a meditation, right? Or just as a the way the instrument can feel. But I'm wondering what question this will be, but this topic, it triggers me, because it's, for you as a musician, you that's your identity, right? To get on stage, to get out there and to share.
Yeah, well, it goes back to what I was saying about school, you know, that's the identity you had pre-social media. It was, oh, this is Mike, he plays guitar. And that kind of carried over to now. So yeah, I think a lot of people lost their way during the lockdowns and stuff, and it's great to be back out playing. I ended up doing a cover of Jump, and, you know, a non-profit cover of Jump, but it took some convincing to do it. it was my girlfriend at the time, was like, you need to like do that. And I was just like, is that going to just come across as crass, you know? And I spoke to Andy Wood about this as well. Mm-hmm. He's like, nah, man, like Eddie wants you to play. And the cool thing about that is that Wolfgang, like, you know, mentioned that he dug it and appreciated it. So that was super validating.
Oh, wow.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If he'd have said he hated it, that would have sucked. That would really sucked. but yeah, no, he's a good dude. He's a good dude for sure.
Talking about Jump, because that arrangement is really beautiful. And what I try to do in the show is some other guests have a question for my next guest and so forth. And so Mark Leggeri was wondering.
Oh, cool. He's awesome.
He is awesome. All guitarists here have to be awesome. That's the only thing. But he asked,
I'd be interested to hear how he just comes up with his arrangements, where he's going to put the bass part versus the melody part, how he fingers that kind of stuff. He did this arrangement of Jump that was like totally nuts.
Yeah.
But you know, a player like that, where he's so virtuosic and we're so totally different, that I almost don't even want to know.
Okay.
I would rather just watch him play and hear him play and be like, there's no point in me trying to figure this out.
So dude, I'm going to ask and I'm not going to ask.
No, I mean that like, honest, like, dude, what you're doing is so your own thing and beyond anything I could comprehend. So I will just be a fan and a listener.
Okay. Hey, good question.
Well, it's a statement.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. How do you make your arrangements? It's a big question, I realize, but can you elaborate a little bit on that?
No, well, I do a fair bit of teaching. I have like a Patreon thing as well where I do some lessons and stuff like that. And this is a question that gets asked quite a lot, and it is a big question. So there's a few different things to consider. It all starts with the song, and do I love the song, first of all? Those two things are, will the song translate into an acoustic guitar instrumental arrangement? Because not all songs do. You can force it, but you're not going to get an emotional response. An example I use is, if I'm doing a rap song, there isn't really a melody in the vocal, so it's not going to translate instrumentally. So much of rap is the lyrics. In fact, all of rap is the lyrics and the beat, you know? So obviously a song has to have what I call a mountain range melody, you know? Mm-hmm. Somebody that I used to know is a great example. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Mountain range melody, like a heartbeat monitor, you know? Mm-hmm. So you've got to have these big leaps. And you have to love the song, because you're going to dissect that thing so hard that if you don't love the song, you're not going to finish it. Mm. And also, you've got to be prepared to hate the song by the time you're done. So you've got to find a song you're willing to sacrifice.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, do you think I'm listening to Everlong? No. No way. Sorry, Dave. Then you find the tuning that will help facilitate that. So, for example, the tuning, and the tuning question is a fork as well. One prong of the fork is, you know, you've got to find a tune that facilitates the song intervallically. For example, is it a rock song? Or maybe you want a fifth in the bass. Maybe you want a D and an A, or a C and a G or something as your bass strings. What does the melody do? Do you need sympathetic strings in a major key or a minor key? Okay, well, maybe we're going to go to a open C minor tuning, or maybe a C major tuning with, you know, do you want some color in it? Do you want it to be modal? Do you want to have the fourth and no? Do you want to take the third out altogether so it can be nice and modal? So you can, and there's different flavors you can kind of add to an arrangement before you even start by working on the tuning. Stick a 9 on the top string. That's a nice little trick to give it some color. And the other prong of that fork with the tuning is, does the tuning sound good on your guitar? That's to do with tension. Mm-hmm. So for example, Jump is in C major, but I play it in D major. The reason I play it in D major is because if I tuned my guitar to a tuning that would work sympathetically for Jump, the strings would be too floppy. It just wouldn't sound as punchy. So I've just tuned it to the same intervals, but at a tension that works on my guitar's scale length and string gauges. So that's all the technical stuff. Mm-hmm. Like you say, it's a big question.
Yeah.
The rest of it is, in terms of how do you do the arrangement, I mean, once I've got what I think is a good tuning and the good song, the tuning's subject to change. I will change the tuning as we go on. Beat by beat, bar by bar.
Does it become easier because you have made arrangements of quite some songs?
Technically easier for the right hand.
Okay.
The right hand is, so when I first started, I was having to come up with different ways to play a bass note and a kick drum sound and a harmonic at the same time. Mm-hmm. These are mechanical lessons. And if I rev my right hand like a motorbike, that enables me to pick a note and thump with the palm of my hand on the guitar to get a kick drum kind of sound. Practice that mechanically for a while, then that becomes a technique, a micro technique. I like to call them micro techniques, which is these combinations of sounds. Mm-hmm. So it gets mechanically easier and quicker in that regard. The arrangements themselves, and then it really is beat by beat, bar by bar, just going through and listening. What's the bass doing? You know, what's the guitar doing? What are the drums doing? Another thing that has gotten, I think I've done a much better job of on this new record. Again, it comes out in the summer. I'm not going to say what the name is in case I haven't announced the name of it when this comes out.
We'll figure it out.
Might be in the description or something. But the thing that I've got really good at on this one, I think, is thinking more like a producer. So when people start arranging, and I'm going to talk about the percussion element, my early arrangements, I'd throw everything, put the kitchen sink at them. So if I needed a snare drum, there's so many different snare sounds you can get on a guitar. You can click the strings, you can hit the side of the guitar with your left hand, you can hit the side of the guitar with your right hand, you can hit the side of the guitar on the top with you can hit the top with your fingernail, you can hit the sound hole with your fingernail. All these different things are in the realms of snare drummy kind of sounds. But if you're in a pop band, the snare drum is the same all the time. Mm. He's not hitting this snare drum and then a piccolo snare and then this and then... And then a rim shot this time. So why would you do that in your acoustic arrangements? So now, and I think Everlong is a good example of this. Slow Dancing in a Burning Room is a good example of this as well, because I'll have one snare for the whole verse, and then the snare will change for the whole chorus. And at least it keeps it consistent as if it was, you know, you got to think like a producer. Mm. So that's something, Foo Fighters, Everlong, it's... There's a little syncopated hit every now and then, but it's pretty much string clicks for the verses. Then the pre-chorus, it goes woody, you know? Mm. So those kind of decisions come with, I think, a little bit of time and maturity and finding out what works and missing a few times and all of that. Other than that, beat by beat, bar by bar. And then be willing to go back and change everything. Mm. Be willing to not get to the end and committing to releasing something if it doesn't kick ass, if maybe you want to change it up a little bit, be willing to kind of sacrifice it if it ain't working, especially when we commit to a tuning. Some things might be out of reach for you, and then you might need to change the tuning and then go back and start again. So I could talk way, way more on this, but I know it's boring.
I'll give Mark your email address so he can have the whole answer.
Definitely don't need to teach Mark anything. He's
no.
The greatest guitar player alive. He's amazing. I've never met the guy, but big fan. Big, big fan.
About questions for other guitar players. Yeah. Before I feed you another Stoopwafel, and before we wrap it up,
choke on another Stoopwafel.
My upcoming guest is Ariel Posen.
Awesome, also, love him. He's amazing.
What do you want to ask him if you could?
Well, Mark gave me a big question, so I guess I should give him a big question as well. So he plays with such feeling and emotion. He's a very good conveyor of emotion. There's some amazing videos I've seen of him online that are just fan filmed, which I think is a real testament. You know someone's a really, really sick player when they have really successful videos that are just bootleg fan footage.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, actual live stuff. That's always a badge of honor for me, for sure. I'm a big fan of his slide playing, but I don't have any experience really with a slide. So for him, I would say, what are his influences in that department? Who has he listened to that made him play the way he does with the slide? And how long did it take him to kind of be able to control his playing to a point of playing so evocatively and precisely? Because he's very precise, but he has a very loose kind of feel, you know?
It's amazing. Yeah.
And I just wonder who his influences are and how long it took him to feel comfortable with the slide.
I'll be talking to him later this week. So
awesome.
Forward.
I think I met him one time. I think we played a festival together in Northern Ireland years ago. And I think we had breakfast at the same time and said, hey, yeah, cool. Bye. I think that was it.
The slide, because on an acoustic guitar, a slide is a different kind of beast also, right? I mean, have you tried it at all?
The problem is I play with a very low action.
Ah, yeah.
And if you play with a slide, with the kind of action that I have, it's just going to sound, you're going to hear the frets, you know?
Which, if you use that in a way, it could work too, maybe.
You know, I know some great fingerstyle players who use a slide. Thomas Lieb has done some really cool stuff with a slide. I did Tommy's guitar camp in Iceland with Jerry Douglas, who plays dobro. So that sound, that kind of sound with what he's doing, incredible. Martin Harley, my first gig I ever did was with Martin Harley when I was 17. Now I've got hiccups, burping, strip, all the time, just garbage.
Coughing, whatever.
I'm a terrible dinner guest. I'll put my elbows down as well. So I think if I were to get into slide in a big way, I think I'd get Andreas Kuntz, who makes my guitars, to make me, he makes dobros as well. So I think I'd get a Kuntz dobro and I'd start like that. Cause I feel like that would be a more expressive mechanic. I feel like I'd love to kind of get the whole hand behind it rather than just kind of a finger. If that makes sense. Well, I guess it's a whole hand. Yeah, I think I'd go the dobro route rather than the low action guitar route.
Mike, it was 45 minutes flew by.
Wow, is it already been 45?
Yeah, man. And
I told you I rambled.
Yeah, no. Thank you so much for coming here. In my in-laws' place, actually.
It's a beautiful place. It's the Netherlands is wild because right now we're below sea level.
Yes,
and there's a river above us right now.
Yeah. People can't say maybe from the video, but you look a tiny little bit afraid, actually.
Afraid, yeah. Yeah. Have you not heard of the Dutch tsunamis? Yeah. That's what the windmills are. They're warning mechanisms.
Yeah, should get this online quickly before you all drown.